some of the world's most popular stock dogs would not have come to be without the unique environmental, economic, and social forces at work on the continent of Australia. And Australia would certainly not be what it is today without its dogs. Guy Hull, author of The Dogs That Made Australia, is here to tell us how this synergy shaped both the dogs and the place. Welcome to Farm Dog. This is Farm Dog, the podcast about the working dogs of farming, ranching, homesteading, and rural living. Farm Dog is presented by Goats on the Go, a national network of independent business owners who provide sustainable weed and brush control for their customers using goats. Want to put goats to work on your vegetation problem? Interested in launching your own goat grazing business? The place to start is goatsonthego.com. Welcome to Farm Dog. I am your host, Aaron Steele. As you know, I am usually really excited to talk to people in the working dog world. Today, I am thrilled to be joined from someone in Australia, Guy Hull, who is the author of a really cool book that I've read and enjoyed immensely, The Dogs That Made Australia. Guy, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Oh, I'm pretty good, thanks, Aaron. How are you doing?
I'm well, and I'm excited to talk to you. Guy, just tell me a little bit about your background and what your interest in dogs is and why you thought this story, which is as much a history telling as it is about dogs, why it needed to be told.
Look, I'm just like everyone else who listens to this podcast. I admire and respect and in my own way love dogs. I'm not an inveterate puppy hugger. Like, I could see a nice dog and admire it by not having to run up and throw my arms around it. But so I've always had an interest in dogs, and I've always had an interest in history. And, you know, we're from the bush, we're from the country, and lots of family have had, you know, sheep properties and things like that. And so I'd grown up hearing these stories about the origins of our working dogs. And like when I was young, I just totally believed it. I thought, oh, yeah, that's where they come from. But after I got into dog behavior. I'm a tertiary educated and qualified dog behaviorist. And the more I learned about behavior, and I was also like an animal control officer with what we call our local councils here, and took a great interest in resolving, say, barking dog problems by getting their people to take their dog for a walk in the morning. resolved hundreds and hundreds of problems without resorting to enforcement, but just by encouraging people just to look after their dogs properly. So I eventually developed a philosophy that it doesn't matter if a dog's on a farm, it doesn't matter if it's living in an apartment, it doesn't matter if it's in a quarter-acre block in suburbia. All dogs have the same instinctive drives, and they're hugely adaptable, but they all need the same things. And if we give any dog the same things, they are what we make them. If we give them all the right stuff, they're going to be fine. It doesn't matter where they live. And it's not much actually that you actually have to do give a dog to keep him happy. So I began to learn more and more about dogs, and I was looking at things like, I love Australian cattle dogs, or, you know, what you Americans call, you know, heelers and things. And they were originally called heelers, and they are a heeler, but. And I was reading the explanation of their origins by a very popular journalist in the early 20th century called Robert Kaleski. And I'm just thinking to myself, that's not right. Like, how do you make a cattle dog? He claimed that cattle dogs basically came from collies. Collies aren't made for that kind of work. A cattle dog back then was made to handle, to wrangle wild cattle that hadn't even seen a fence, would only see a person once a year, and in some cases was born in the bush, born in the wild, and have maybe didn't see anyone for the first 2 or 3 years of its life, and then someone's trying to manage it. So that's what these dogs are developed for. The heeler's job these days is redundant, basically. We don't really, unless you're dealing with really wild cattle, but we can talk about those kind of things later. But I just thought, no, that's not right, can't be right. That's just not right. You don't make a pushing, dry, hard, nasty, hard-driving dog out of a gathering, a gentle, sheep-working, gathering dog that gathers stock and brings them towards you. I thought, that's just not right. But I really didn't know where to look or what happened. But then one day I found this really basic and crude website by a man named Bert Howard that gave an explanation for the development of the Hall's Heel, the progenitor of the Australian cattle dog and the Australian stumpy tail cattle dogs. And I thought, that's just right. That's just what that man, and he unknowingly used the rule of Occam's razor. You know that rule, Occam's razor, the rule of Occam's razor, which says that whenever you're trying to work out a problem, the simplest explanation is generally the one that's correct. And Bert Howard, through proper research, not speculation like Kolesky, Bert Howard, it was a man in his late 70s when he developed this. Did this research. He found out it was a cross between two. It was a crossbreeding between two different species. Basically, one was a cur, a short tailed, stumpy tailed, a driving dog and protective dog from England that the Hall family bred for centuries over there, and the dingo. Simple. Simple. And that. You call them mixes, we call them crosses here. That crossbreeding produced progeny, one that was like a mini dingo with a tail, red or blue, and the other one was a rectangular dog, and the other one they produced out of that same crossing was a squarish dog without a tail, red or blue, which is just like the cur, like bingo, there it is. And, people in the kennel club over here were poo-pooing everything he said because, he was against what Kolesky said. But Robert Kolesky just made stuff up. Robert Kolesky just – you might have noticed my treatment of Robert Kolesky in the book. But Kolesky in those days, look, even the early 20th century, newspapers were syndicated. Australia's as big as the USA, right? Mm-hmm. It's a big place. It's a really big place. But in the middle of it all, we just got desert. So it's only like the fringes around the coast and slightly in the interior a bit that are really populated to any degree. Our major cities obviously are. But back then they syndicated, it must have all been by Morse code, or they mailed it off and just published things, a week later or something. But the whole of Australia, Kolesky was a very popular writer, and people loved what he had to say because he was entertaining, right? There's no question about it. But the bloke was clueless. Like, he was just made stuff up and everyone believed it. Like, Australia's come up with some really magnificent dog breeds, but the general dog, the national gross dog intelligence of Australia is pretty low, Aaron. I hate to say it.
So Robert Kolesky is an important character in your book. You usually don't think of historical books as having characters, but it's certainly the case here with Kolesky. So tell us a little bit more about who this guy was and how he affected how Australians thought about dogs.
Robert Kolesky was a journalist. He was Sydney born. His father was a Pole and his mother was an Anglo-Australian. And he was born the year, I'm pretty sure it was the year or very close to the year that Thomas Hall, the man who developed the Hall's Heelers, died. Now, the Hall's Heelers were developed. The Halls had a string of properties that ran half the length of Australia or maybe even more also on the eastern side of Australia, not coastal but eastern side. And their range of properties even included holding yards in Sydney that still sort of bear name, a suburb called Auburn, that still bear the names of, that bound their holding paddocks. And so it wasn't really very hard. It wasn't Heelers, I'll get on to Kolesky, but Heelers were the first working breed that was really developed in Australia, but they were a privately owned breed. Only the Hall Empire had them, and that's why they got the jump on everyone. That was a great innovation. And look, we all know how useful farm dogs are. They probably might even be more useful than having three sons on your property, Aaron. Right? Dogs are pretty. Dogs are pretty useful. Yeah, they're cheap. They're cheap to maintain. And so once Thomas Hall died, all those properties were sold up and dispersed, and the dogs became available for people to own. So all their competitors obviously got them. There would have been crossbreedings when they were out droving and moving stock around. Things would have happened. Some people obviously would have got hold of them through fair means or foul. But after Thomas Hall died, they became very popular in Sydney, the tail dogs. The tailless, stumpy-tailed dogs are more popular over the border of northern New South Wales and into Queensland. And the tail dogs were more popular with the horse cattlemen down south. And the ones down south they made it into Sydney in the hands of dog exhibitors, of dog breed enthusiasts, because at the same time, dog showing was exploding as a hobby around the world. You know, dog breeds started to become defined then, people writing breed standards for them. So dog showing became really big business. Dog showing now is nothing compared to what it used to be. It was at its height back then. So Kolesky and his mates in Sydney, I'm being polite, got hold of some of these dogs, and they weren't not very good specimens either, and they started breeding them and showing them. So Kolesky was pretty smart. Like, he realised no one knew anything about them. So being a journalist, Kolesky, we got a saying, one of the main streets in Sydney, it's now a mall, but one of the main streets in Sydney is Pitt Street, named after the English Prime Minister Pitt. And so we've got a saying in Australia that someone's a Pitt Street farmer, you know, like the smaller the property, the bigger the hat, you know, and they've got these little tiny acres. So Kolesky had 5 or 10 acres on the edge of Sydney at a place called Liverpool, basically, which is just like everything else. It's just all suburbia now. And so he set himself up as the archetypal bushman, you know, the laconic sort of, you know.
I see.
Did the same part. You missed Mr. Big Bushman, and he really wasn't. But he wrote entertaining things, and he started teaching people about, you know, the bush and Australian culture, because all Australians really got about the bushman was some of our famous poets who were, you know, quite descriptive about the bush, and it was always these larger-than-life characters, you know, in these fictitious poems that Kolesky sought to emulate. So Kolesky became the world authority on blue heelers, right? So he wrote a breed standard for them that in itself, probably in a small way, well, it wasn't brilliant, but he did say in the standard they should be like a small dingo, built like a small dingo. He totally ignored the tail dogs. He probably didn't even know about the tail dogs. But what Kolesky didn't do is go and talk to the people who actually knew. There were plenty of people of his contemporaries around who would work for the halls. The Sydney abattoirs were using them all the time and had been using them since they became available, or maybe even before they became available. There were fellows there that he could have gone and spoken to at any time if he'd chosen to, but he chose not to, or if he did, he didn't like what they told him, and it didn't suit his angle on his take on the breed. So Kolesky wrote his own spurious, I'll say that advisedly, spurious history for the dogs. So people loved it. He just made stuff up. And look, it was a different time back then, and people were a lot harder on animals back then. But if you ever read Kolesky's book, if you can stomach it, it's just full of cruelty. It's just like, is misogynistic and really, really terribly misogynistic and really cruel to his animals, and they just had barbaric action. They had no idea, just absolutely no idea how to manage a dog at all. Whereas at the same time, as Kolesky was writing all that stuff, in southern New South Wales, the Kelpie emerged. And we'll talk about the Kelpie bit in more detail later. And those men were brilliant. They were brilliant dog handlers, dog breeders, and they all used gentleness with their dogs, right? But the other thing that they did to really legitimise their breeds and popularise their breeds was have their dogs engage in trials. And if you wanted to even show a dog back then, so if you wanted to put your dog in a dog trial, in a sheepdog trial back then, it had to actually compete in a confirmation show to show that it was of a sound type. But they were pretty sort of loose. They weren't like people scratching each other's eyes out to win a ribbon or a few challenge points as they are these days. But so the Kelpie had a big, big leg up through intelligent management. The cattle dogs Their management was restricted to Robert Kalisky and his fertile imagination. So, and to be fair, it wasn't the type of dog then that you could easily trial, because by then, you know, the fences were up and the rail system was sort of established and cattle weren't but being walked hundreds of miles to market. So being walked, you know, a much, much shorter distance than that and put on trains. And at the same time, worldwide, particularly in England, dogs that were doing that work, like the curs over there, became overnight extinct. No one wanted it, needed them anymore, because there was no need for them anymore. So that's one of the things about working all breeds, but particularly working breeds. If it doesn't have a job, it's not going to last. If it doesn't have a job, and it doesn't make an attractive pet, it's not going to last very long as a breed. It's going to just, you know, die out and disappear in the end. So yeah, Kalesky got write-offs. So he became a reporter on sheepdog trials as well, and got right up the nose of all the Kelpie men. They just couldn't stand the sight of him. And all the stupid things that he read. He just wrote stupid things, like ridiculous things. Like, if someone wrote it today, you'd think it was a 15-year-old girl or child or boy who's deeply in love with dogs writing some cutesy anthropomorphic thing on social media. It was, some of the things he wrote was just ridiculous. So, and it went from one extreme to the other. It was either cutesy and lovey-lovey or cruel and sort of nasty. But people kind of like believed it. He got called out by scientists. He got called out by the dog men, and all he did was use his position in the press to lampoon those people and make fun of them. He was an acolyte of a mad professor in Melbourne, who was just off with the pixies. Like, seriously, he had no idea. And Kalesky came up with theories that the dogs were descended from marsupial lions and all that kind of stuff. He created all these images of all these wild big beasts, you know, living in the bush and devouring people, and, you know, creating havoc everywhere. And of course, it was all just a pack of lies, but not unless I've got it wrong and Kalesky was just pulling everyone's leg just for the fun of it. But he came across as being pretty serious. So he wrote books that were execrable, terrible books full of nonsense and misinformation. And as a result, the working Kelpie people wouldn't have anything to do with him. And there was our genuine giants from, you know, obviously the people on farms and on cattle stations or ranches and doing all the hard work with their dogs that never get any publicity, just doing it like everything everywhere. The real soul of the earth people are the ones that don't have the publicity. They're the ones just doing all the hard work, likewise their dogs. So yeah, that's basically was Kalesky. He lived till a long time, and he was instrumental in having the German Shepherd banned from Australia for 75 years, because he convinced the wool industry they were going to crossbreed with dingoes and destroy the wool industry. So big wool. Remember what I said about the national gross dog intelligence of Australia? Like, you're dealing with people who would just believe a cock and bull story like that and just go screaming to Parliament. So as a result, because of Kalesky, they banned the importation of, and for a while, they were going to make everyone destroy their German Shepherds if they had them here. One of the world's greatest breeds. Like, they shouldn't really be called Shepherds, because, look, they're not a working dog like a Collie, like any of the Collies are. They're like a pushing, herding, guarding, protective sort of type dog, but one of the world's greatest breeds, obviously. And so Kalesky had them banned for over 70 years, and to my smug satisfaction, but the publishers wouldn't do it, I actually read and wrote in my manuscript that Kalesky died the year Rin Tin Tin premiered in on Australian television over here. So that was pretty prophetic.
That is really fascinating, you know, that he had such an effect that it was until the 80s, correct, before German Shepherds were allowed to be brought into Australia again, the early 80s?
Yep. And so as a result, Australia ended up with this gene pool of inbred, pathetic German Shepherds. But at the same time, The New South Wales Police Dog Squad, which was like the world-leading dog squad for police forces, managed to get by, but a lot of theirs died early or died from reasons they couldn't put it down to. But they did sort of very well with a few of their dogs. But yeah, Kolesky caused a real lot of damage, and even today, the preamble to the Australian cattle dog, Australian stumpy-tailed cattle dog, and the Australian Kelpie breed standards are incorrect. They're written by Kolesky. Bert Howard, who's now has passed away a couple of years ago, and I, on several occasions, approached the Australian National Kennel Council, and they just told us to go away. They didn't want to hear anyone saying anything bad about Robert Kolesky. So there.
Oh wow! So his his ripple effects continue to this day to some extent. Is that partly why you felt you wanted to write this book, to kind of correct some of the damage that Kolesky had done?
Oh, absolutely. That was one, probably the main reason. I had to be polite about it. But like I have people approach me. I've tried to really seriously minimize my social media footprint because the weight of stuff I get from people around the world, I just can't cope with it. And I'm happy to like talk to someone like you, but you know, there's a lot of people who want to talk to me about my book, and I haven't got time. I have a life to lead, and I'm glad that people love it, and it's really great that people love it. But the damage that he's done, and the vitriol I get from people, like, how dare you criticize Robert Kolesky? Like, you just think, like, okay, then, like, if that's really, you really want to believe that that's where they came from, like they were crossbred with Dalmatians. Like, I have problems really adequately expressing myself without resorting to profanity, Aaron. It I've never heard to give them a love of endurance and a love of horses. Now, this is a bunch of show people, 30 or 40 or 50 years, or well, even longer than that, like 100 years after the dogs were developed for a job, saying that they needed to be improved, and they're prancing around the show ring with them. And this is a kind of nonsense that Kolesky promulgated and people believed. And the fact is, there was one attempted cross between with some a couple of his mates who had a Dalmatian. In fact, the Chief Justice of the judicial system in New South Wales actually owned that Dalmatian, and his friends, the Baggists, got this Justice Stephen to loan the dog for the deed, and they produced a litter that was obviously useless. It's like people trying to, you know, cross Kelpies with dingoes and think they're going to get a superior sheepdog out of a sheep killer. Like just go figure. But so there was one cross. It was obviously useless. It just faded away. But Kolesky made it sound like it was how they were developed, and people around the world still think. See, Kolesky fell into the trap of seeing superficial similarities as proof of breeding. He saw speckled dogs. Now, look, speckling is a colour, not merle, but speckling is a colour that you get in cattle dogs. He thought, oh, well, that's obviously come from the Dalmatian, because it's like speckling. Like the Kelpie had to come from a fox because it was red.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, and it had a brushed tail. It had to come from a fox. So everyone went, oh, yeah, Kelpies in Australia. Like, they'll still tell you, oh, yeah, no, mate, they come from foxes, mate. You got it all wrong. People call me, try and track down my number and send me an email saying, they come from foxes, mate. You got it all wrong. So that's the kind of thing I've got to deal with all the time. So and it's pretty ingrained. And people really, look, lots of people read the book and go, I haven't actually had anyone who's sensible contact me and say, I hated your book. It was wrong, right? I've had a few people who are in the industry who have tried to write things that haven't been successful, haven't liked my book. But most people enjoy the book, and most people can probably understand why I thought it needed to be written and why we need to, like, the breed histories of these dogs is really quite simple. It's nothing very complicated. Occam's razor. The most simple explanation is generally the best one.
Yeah, absolutely. So, one of the things that fascinates me about, well, dogs of all breeds and types, but especially working dogs, is that they're such a function, like they're inseparable from culture, they're inseparable from politics, from agriculture, from all the forces that make humanity humanity. Like they just are functions of that. You can't tease them apart. Koleski's a perfect example of that. He had his finger on culture in Australia, and the impact was severe, not good necessarily. But one of the cool things I like about your book is that if any of you folks listening right now would like to know about more about the history of Australia, but you don't think about yourself usually as being fascinated with history. This is what a fantastic way to get a history lesson, to do it through the context of dogs, because Guy's book does an amazing job of that. And that in itself is worth the read. It's just a fantastic history lesson. And Guy, I think all of it, when our audience members hear the title of your book, The Dogs That Made Australia, their minds either go directly to the breeds we know here in the United States that the first word is Australia or Australian, right? Or their mind goes immediately to the dingo. And one of the amazing things I learned from your book is that the dingo is a domesticated dog become undomesticated, or a tame dog become untame. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I might expand, yeah, sure, but I might expand on that. It was a wild dog that became a domestic dog that became a wild dog. So essentially, it's probably the story of every feral dog in the world, but it's a really unique story. It was, look, if you look at the dogs of Asia, so they think, when I was writing my book, I contacted a very prominent Australian biologist named Mike Letnich, who's does has done a lot of work with dingoes. He's a wonderful man. And I said to him, I don't reckon, well, here's my theory. I don't reckon it's a theory. I reckon this is the truth. Let's just get one thing straight. Let's just wind back a little bit, Aaron. Dogs did not come from wolves. Dogs did not come from wolves. No one has ever been able to domesticate a wolf and turn a wolf into a dog. No one, not even today with all these different, advanced techniques. How on earth were cave people ever expected to really do that? Now, I've developed this theory more since I've written my book. But I said to Mike, I don't reckon they come from wolves. And he says, you might be perfectly right. There's digs on going on in China now where they believe that they've found a very, very primitive form of canine that was not a wolf, that was associated with human beings. So I reckon there's always been wild dogs. So I reckon like there were wild horses and wild zebras. There's different kinds of, and so with canines, there's wolves. There's foxes, there's coyotes and jackals. Why couldn't there be wild dogs originally? So I reckon I wrote that it would have been a small, ostracized wolf from a pack when I wrote my book. But actually, since that time, probably believe more that there was probably wild dogs because they've
I
never
see.
done the wolf. They've never been able to do the wolf thing. So if I ever get to do a revised edition, I'll probably change that. But it's probably, look, and like I said, there would have been women who did it, not men, not Gronk walking around with his spear and his mates and his spear and his spears and clubs, right? Fine. There would have been whoever had the food because we all know, or we should all know, or we ought to know, that if you want to control a dog, you control the food. You control the food and you control absolutely everything. And I know that everyone thinks their dogs love them. Their dogs are not really capable of human love, but they're capable of wanting to feed, get themselves well fed. So, in the domestic situation, who does the dog generally love the most in the home? It's generally mum. Because she is the one with the food. Or if dad's doing the grill or the barbecue, we call it here, well, it's dad. Whoever's got the food, holds all the power. And not enough people know how to use food to control their dogs. That's all you need to do. You get a, I know I'm sidetracking a little bit, but with my work as a behaviorist, and if anyone's listening, if you're having trouble sorting your dog, getting your dog to focus on you, or to get, to obey you, don't feed it for a day and see how much, and have some food with you and see how much notice your dog starts taking of you then. Or if you need to, I've had cases of really aggressive dogs that I have not fed for 3 days and they become like kittens in your hand and will do absolutely anything for you. So people go, oh, it's cruel, all the mad people go, oh, it's cruel, it's cruel, it's mad. It's not cruel. A dog's lucky in the wild. Dogs like dingo be lucky to eat once a week, right? And most of them in the wild are quite thin, all bone showing. We grossly overfeed our dogs, and that's the half the problem, or most of the problem of disobedience in dogs. I've very rarely been. I'll train to a behavioural consult where the dog is really, really fit looking, or even a little bit underweight. Generally, they're all fat. They've always got access to food. They don't need to do anything for anyone because they've got food. But anyway, the dingo story. Let me sort of get back to the dingo story, Aaron. So the dingo, that wild dog, all throughout Asia, all the dogs are relatively similar. They're all kind of dingo-like. All the village dogs, all the street dogs. There's a lot of crossbreeding with them now, and other breeds been put into them since, like breeds became popular and people started keeping dogs mostly as pets. But they're generally a medium size, generally erect-eared, but crossbreeding is a lot of cause a lot of the ears to fall. Short, double-coated dog of rectangular shape. And they're all and them and the dingo, New Guinea singing dog as well. They're all drawn from the same stock. They came to Australia probably with the Lapita people, who were the Asian people who populated the Pacific. And to get to the Pacific, generally you just got to sweep down through along the top of Australia. Those people probably stopped by, and the indigenous people, the Aboriginal people of Australia, were probably given them as in trade for goods. Or in tribute for people to be able to stop and stage there and play things like that. They got into the hands of Indigenous people about 5,000 years ago. And God bless them, the Australian Indigenous people have never farmed and never kept animals. They're semi-nomadic hunters and gatherers, and that's all they are. And they really didn't have the skills to maintain a dog because 5,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 12,000 years ago, maintaining a dog is exactly the same as maintaining a dog today, except back then, people managed to do it with a bit of greenhide rope and a bit of food and a bone. Now we need all technology and food and toys and this and that to maintain a dog is ridiculous, right? Basically, by controlling food, you control dogs. And that's the way people have traditionally always done it. And also by physically restraining them. So, and giving them boundaries. Material boundaries and invisible boundaries. Look, you don't bite, you don't do this. Back in the day, if they were savage or they were raised to be teased and became aggressive, let's get hit on the head and eaten probably, so, or just hit on knocked on the head. But so they came to Australia and were given to Indigenous people, and they just didn't control them. They just didn't know how to manage them. So what do dogs do if there's not enough food at home? If there's not enough exercise at home, if there's not enough shelter at home, or there's not enough water at home, or not enough company at home, what do dogs do? They jump the fence and they go. Or they walk out the side gate that someone's continually leaves open and they go and find a better deal for themselves because another rule of dog behavior is a dog will always take the better offer. If you're not the better offer, your dog's not going to listen to you. All right. So you've always got to be the best offer. And they had a better offer. They came into a country that was just teeming with game, a lot of small game and a lot of small harm, a bit of dangerous stuff in crocodiles and poisonous snakes and things. But they just started, well, as we say in Australia, cutting their own tracks, looking after themselves, but probably living on the periphery, like they still do, and as they did for centuries. So Aboriginal people would go find a den. Take puppies out of the den. Everyone loves a puppy. Like for people living hard like that, a puppy would have been a great joy for a while, like until like all of us, until they reach adolescence. To the stage where they became nuisances. Imagine, like I've said in the book, imagine trying to run, you know, cook food on the ground with half a dozen of those things, starving things, half starving things running around. You'd be continually flogging them off. So eventually they either left home or they got, you know, driven out, and they went back to the pack. And so dingoes and indigenous people had this quite a symbiotic relationship, that they became this power sharing apex predators together. Dingoes weren't frightened of indigenous people. Like, you see a dingo now, they see a person now, they're gone. But because they learned to distrust Anglo-Saxon people, Aaron, right? And for good reason too. But so that's basically the story. They spread through from the very, very northern part of the Northern Territory, that big square part of Australia. They swept right through the mainland continent. They conquered every single environment that there is to conquer. They adapted to every single environment, from tropical jungles to tropical savanna to semi-arid, complete, you know, like there's not very many in the what they call the dead heart, where it's just sand. Like there's not much to sustain them there, but every habitable environment they've conquered, except they couldn't make it to Tasmania because of the Bass Strait, that 200-mile strip between the bottom of Australia and Tasmania. While they were conquering the mainland, the Tasmanian tiger, the thylacine, was the chief predator on the mainland. They'd competed them and wiped them out. And they also wiped the little Tassie devils out, which were all over the mainland as well. So they completely dominated and took it for their own, like complete. But at the same time, here's the thing, you know, like I also wrote a book called The Ferals That Ate Australia. And it's a story about all the feral animals that have come to Australia and have destroyed the joint, like it's happening to you with a lot of creatures that have come to the United States and North America. But the dingo was the one feral animal that actually made itself at home, did a bit of damage, but it's become part of the furniture now. So it's accepted as a true native. And, you know, if you want to come to Australia and try sheep farming, so they wanted to come to Australia and grow wool, well, they say that Australia grew a road to prosperity on the sheep's back. Well, probably really the Kelpies did all the hard work for that. But it also came at great environmental expense, and getting rid of the dingoes was like removing any top apex predator is really, really bad for the environment. It's actually really bad for the environment. Strychnine was used, tons and tons and hundreds of tons of strychnine were used to try and eliminate them. They got them. You can get rid of dingoes on the plains, like on the prairie. If you're on the prairie, you can get rid of dingoes, but you never get rid of them out of the areas that they love the most, which is a mountain range or mountainous country bordered by downs and plains and things. They can go and hunt in the open country and then get refuge up in the mountains. And they've never, the Great Dividing Range is like the spine of Australia, runs down the east coast from the very, very tip of Cape York, right on the very tip of Queensland, all the way down to the bottom of Victoria, through Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria. They've never got them out of there, and they will never get them out of there because it's just too wild and there's too much for them to do there. So the dingo is persecuted beyond all belief in Australia. It's actually a disgrace the way the dingo is treated. If you want to grow sheep in Australia, you're going to have to kill dingoes. That's just the way that it works. If you're in there's some areas that are dingo-free, but there's always something to replace them. You know, there might be, you know, dingoes, but they have just as much trouble with foxes, because if there's dingoes in an area, there's no foxes. So it's like foxes do so much damage. They just do damage to smaller sheep, not the bigger sheep, let the dingoes do. So they kill lambs at lambing time and stuff. So, you know, it's here. It's probably the most intelligent canine that's ever been around. They have remarkable physical characteristics. They're just an absolute super predator. They're small. It's just a medium-sized dog. And they should be one of Australia's national like faunal symbols, but they're just like declared noxious. They're just declared pests in most places, and I once again refer to Australia's gross national dog intelligence, or IQ, Aaron. Not very high.
So the dingo ends up shaping agriculture in Australia a great deal, and also some of the dogs that are used in agriculture in Australia. But in between, there's this intervening period as British colonization begins that leads to the development of another dog that was entirely new to me. And your book spends a lot of time on this dog, and I think rightfully so. But it was all new to me, and I think it'll be all new to our audience. So I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit about kangaroo dogs.
Yeah, look, I'd be happy to talk about them. They were quite a unique dog, but they shouldn't be all that new to Americans because you had the same dog over there on the prairie hunting.
If you've enjoyed this conversation with Guy Hull so far, you're definitely going to want to tune in next week. We're going to post a bonus episode that is part two of this conversation with Guy. It went long and we had a lot of stuff to cover. Guy Hull's book is rich and thick, and I just didn't want to let go without touching on each and every dog almost that he discussed in his book. And so come back next week as we tackle part two with Guy Hull. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to Farm Dog. If you enjoyed this episode or any of the other episodes, please subscribe, leave us a positive review, and tell someone about it. Thanks.